This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, along with my producer, Lee Della Pina, and each and every week I have the opportunity to visit with so many of the people which helped to make this sport go, and I'm talking about those individuals which are accustomed to getting up at the crack of dawn. They do it each and every day of the year. There are no holidays for trainers as they have to be at the barn every single day, and the two individuals I'm going to speak with tonight just epitomize what this game is all about. They are hard workers, and they have been at it for, well, not a long time, but long enough to make their mark in the world of thoroughbred racing. Want to welcome everybody tuning in on Sirius 93, and for those of you who have been with us over the past 3 hours with our live racing coverage on XM 209 and streaming worldwide on our website at horseracingradio.net, welcome back to Trainer Talk here on HRRN. Seth Benzel, our first guest here tonight. He will be followed in the second half of the program by Chris Richard. So without further ado, let's get right to it. Seth Benzel, the 38-year-old born in Clifton Springs, New York. He has saddled 117 career winners with purse earnings of more than $4 million. And he's nice enough to be with us here on Trainer Talk tonight. Seth, thanks so much, buddy.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And look, Clifton Springs is not a big city. I think when I looked it up, The population, what, between 2,000 and 3,000 people. Talk about your hometown and about how you got bit by the racing bug growing up in Clifton Springs.
Sure. Well, actually, you know, you're correct. I was born in Clifton Springs. I grew up in Newark, New York, which is not far. And like Clifton, a very small town, but Finger Lakes Racetrack was just about 30 minutes away, and my father began breeding horses when I was younger, so I got the pleasure of seeing that in full swing and being a part of it, being around the foals, and soon our offspring started to run, and that introduced me to the track at a very young age. Basically, first I was a fan, but then as soon as I could hold a pitchfork and walk a horse, I was doing it. I was involved at a very young age and enjoyed it. You know, really, really felt like from the very beginning it was something I wanted to do, and I was fortunate enough to be introduced to it and have a lot of great people at Finger Lakes Racetrack that taught me, you know, the ins and outs. And, you know, I really started learning about, you know, training techniques and riding and all the basics that it took, you know, that I still use today.
So you knew right away that this was the only thing you ever wanted to do was be around the racetrack. Did you always know that you wanted to be a trainer?
Well, originally when I first started riding, I wanted to be a jockey, you know. But the other thing I wanted to do is I wanted to be able to eat whenever I wanted. So within a short period of time, I grew too big and didn't ever get a chance to become a jockey. So on the list of second best was a trainer. And I think now, you know, being older and being in the game, it's definitely what I was meant to do. And I'm glad that my weight made the choice for me and pushed me along, because I feel like I set out on the road very early, and that's been a huge help to me.
Was your dad excited when you told him that you wanted to start training horses?
Well, yeah, he was. I mean, he could see, you know, right from the get-go that I was very interested. He saw how much work I put into it. You know, he said, you have to go to college, obviously, and get a college experience, which I'm glad that he made me do, because it was a great part of my life. But even in college, I found a college where I could still ride horses and be involved in a horse program, so that was great. But yeah, there was no doubt, and he still enjoys it now, watching our horses and just seeing that, you know, it's a living that I've made, and he loves to be a part of it.
Yeah, and you didn't venture far from home to go to college either, right? Wasn't it somewhat local?
You know, it was 4 hours away, but it was in Ohio. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't that far, and it was one of the few places that I could find both of my interests. You know, obviously we know about the thoroughbred and the trainer part, but I'm also an artist and a painter, and that school had both programs. So I was very fortunate to be able to pick a school where I could pursue both interests and do so freely.
Yeah, talk about your interest in the arts. What sparked that, and is that something that you've always had an interest in?
Yeah, pretty much. Just like horses, it was something that was started at a very young age. My father was a painter, an architect by profession, but he started me painting at a very early age as well. And so, you know, that kind of progressed right along with the horses, and it's something that I enjoy. And obviously, I would say a majority of my time and a majority of my attention goes to the horses, but I also am disciplined enough to make some time out for painting, and you know, I enjoy that facet of my you know, after work activities as much as anything. So it's gone into basically a great hobby of mine.
Yeah, it's interesting you had mentioned the time factor, because one of the things I always enjoy doing on this program is asking trainers what they like to do when they're not at the racetrack. And so many trainers will say, well, I don't have time for anything else because this is such an all-time-consuming profession. But it sounds like you really make an effort to take time away from the racetrack and to spend time doing your painting.
I do, and it's difficult. I mean, I definitely probably should have more work than I do at this point in my life, but, you know, I'm glad that I have something else to go to, you know, something else to push me, even though they're very correct in the fact that this takes a lot of time and it's hard to have anything else. But at the end of the day, you know, you have to, as a person, you have to have something that kind of balances it, because the horses can become overwhelming as well if you don't have something like that. So I'm fortunate enough to have another interest that when I do have some free time, I can do that and experience that as well.
Do you find it to be somewhat of a release from the racetrack end of things?
Yeah, for sure. There's no doubt. I mean, you know, I think that it kind of exercise a whole other part of my personality, and at the same time, I think that there's always been a commonality between art and horses. You know, if you look at some of the major horse sales you go to, a lot of times there's an art show going on or something of that matter, and obviously horses have been their own subject of many artists as well. So I think that there's some commonality as well, and I enjoy that. So for sure there's a release there, and you know, I think that the exercises, you know, both in exercises impact each other, and that's something that I've always really enjoyed.
What types of paintings do you actually get into, Seth, and what's probably your favorite thing to paint?
Yeah, well, I tend to keep it more on the abstract side. I do large 4x4, like 4 foot by 4 foot large abstract paintings. That's one of the things is that when I go into a painting, it's very open-ended. I don't know what it's going to be, and I think that that's a huge part of why I like to do it, is there's so much about the horses that's exacting that, you know, you can see everything kind of happen before you. But with painting, it's very open-ended. You never know what you're going to create, and that's why I like to keep it that way. Occasionally, a horse will pop up in my paintings, and I'll bring it out. Occasionally, a person or something of that matter. But I would like to remain, you know, fairly abstract, non-objective, and that's always been pretty successful for me as far as what I think, you know, I use my creativity the most in that arena.
Trainer Seth Benzel joining me on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Seth, you mentioned starting to work with horses around Finger Lakes. That was kind of where you broke your maiden, so to speak. That was at a very young age, somewhere around the age of 14, I guess. talk about what those early days were like and some of the people that helped you there as you were just getting started in the game.
Yeah, well, I basically worked for two guys. Luis Garcia was a trainer at the time. He's now a jockey's agent there locally, but he's a very good horseman. He worked for Billy Badgett, and he was a great early influence because he did things more or less the way they were doing it, things in New York at that time, you know, very high quality. And he just knew the basics very well, and he was also a jockey in his own career. So at the time, I was from a jockey and pursuing that interest, and he was fundamental in just giving me the exercises, the ins and outs, and pretty much the basics. From there, I went to work with Dave Margraf, who's very involved with young horses. We would come down to Ocala, Florida, and break horses and then bring them to the racetrack. So between those two guys, I got great fundamentals as far as just training and the ins and outs and even, you know, riding. I would say I probably made the biggest stride because I went in not really knowing how to ride all that well, and I think I came out a very competent rider and ended up, you know, galloping for Bill Mott straight from Finger Lakes. So it was a great school as far as riding and training.
Yeah, you mentioned Hall of Famer Bill Mott. You had the opportunity to learn from two of the best that the sport has ever seen in Bill and, of course, a future Hall of Famer in Todd Pletcher. Let's start with Bill, because I know that he was the one that you credit as giving you a big break. Is it true that you just went up to him one day and said, hey, I need a job and I'll do whatever you need?
Yeah, basically, you know, I was there at Belmont. I knew, even though I had trained for 2 years at Finger Lakes on my own and I had winners and everything like that, that was basically for me just a taste of, look, this is what it's all about. This is what winning a race means. But at the same time, I knew that if I was going to do it, I wanted to do it at a top level. And in order to do that, you know, to just keep training as a young person and not have more experience, I felt I would be up against it a little bit. So I let everything go at Finger Lakes and went up to Bill and asked him for a galloping job and said basically I would do anything he wanted me to do just to be a part of his stable. And that's the attitude I took for the first year, you know, that I was with him, is I wanted to be around the barn. I wanted to see everything that happened. And it was really an amazing process for me looking back because, you know, to go from where I grew up and to see, you know, to be around those kind of horses and the next day be around like Athena, Agena, all these fantastic horses is really a culture shock, but one that I completely, you know, just tried to use to the nth degree. It was a great experience.
Yeah, what if you could put your finger on the one thing, or maybe even a couple of things that you took away from those years of working with Bill Mott that you're still employing with your operation today, what would those things be?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the one thing Bill was always great at was just reading a horse where they were, how they needed to be campaigned, and, you know, how to bring those horses along. I think that once you get to a certain level, it's all about the preparation. It's all about making the right decisions as far as picking races and things of that sort. And Bill's a great campaigner. I think that there's nobody better when it comes to putting together a season that accentuates the later half and when, you know, the races start to get to where you're starting to you know, decide championships and obviously the Breeders' Cup and everything of that nature. There's nobody better to bring a horse along through a season so that they're peaking at the right time than Bill. You know, fundamentals about his program, he spends a lot of time on the horses. They're always very laid back. And, you know, just also the horses that he had teaches you a lot. You know, with both him and Todd, I think that's another thing that's understated is obviously those guys are fantastic at everything they do, but just being around those kind of horses teaches you so much, more than they're going to tell you directly. And that was, you know, for me to have that experience and be around those kind of horses was just something that was priceless.
What led to the decision to transfer from working with Bill Mott and then move over to working with Todd?
Well, there was an opportunity, you know, George Weaver had gone out on his own, and Cindy, his wife, also were two very large part of Todd Fletcher's operation at the time, and they were obviously going into business together, and that left two spots in Todd's operation. So when I heard of that opportunity, you know, I was looking for something that at that time I had done two winters in New York as Bill's assistant, and I wanted to be around young horses again. And that opportunity that George had there was with the babies in Saratoga, and I felt like that was a great opportunity to go to work for somebody who was obviously very good with younger horses and would give me, you know, the opportunity to be ahead of a string of horses without any interruption throughout the year. So for me, it was just another extension of the education, you know, and the experience, and I felt it was a good step forward. It was hard to leave Bill because really when I went to work for him, I said I'll be with him, you know, until I decide to go out on my own. But you never know in life. You know, sometimes there's a door that opens that leads you in another direction, and it was really a circumstance of that, and I was lucky enough to have it and take advantage of it.
How much different, or was it much different in terms of Todd's philosophy as opposed to what you saw with Bill Mott when you were working with him?
I mean, really, when it comes down to it, there isn't a huge difference, but there is little differences. And when you get to operations like that, you know that the basics are going to be met. You know, those guys all have tremendous operations where, you know, their employees know what they have to do to take care of not only the large aspects of training, but also the little details. And they wouldn't be able to have large operations if they didn't all do that. But within that, there are small differences that I picked up on that I thought were very interesting. And, you know, forever I'll use that in different situations where those guys made important decisions. And that was the best part of it, is you knew going in to Todd's from Bill's that you're now going to be a part of an operation that wins just as many races, you know, hits the wire at the same time, a lot of time with nice horses, and at the same time, their programs were very different. So for me, it was a great, you know, it would have been one thing to go to work for somebody who was sort of like Bill. I don't think that education would have been the same. In this circumstance, it was totally different, but at the same time, their programs are the same as far as all the detail and everything that they do to do a good job. So it was great seeing both ways of doing it.
You mentioned working around horses like a Cena and a Gina when you were with Bill. And then, of course, when you were with Todd, those were the years of Rags to Riches and English Channel and a Shadow and so many of his really top horses he's had the chance to be around.
Yep.
You talked about playing this game at a very high level. When you're around horses of that caliber and you're learning around the best, both on the equine side of things and on the human side of things, Seth, does that make you want to compete at that level even more?
Oh, for sure. I mean, being around a good horse just makes you want to find another one. I mean, I think that's what drives everybody in the game. Obviously, to arrive at a good horse, there's a lot of work involved, and there's a lot of horses in between as well. But when you come up on a good horse, and a lot of times when you have a good horse of that caliber that those horses have reached, you'll know it very soon. It doesn't mean that it comes necessarily easy, but you know that if you lead them over there, you do your job, you lead them over there in a good frame of mind, healthy, that they're gonna perform well. And that's probably the greatest feeling about being around a really nice horse, is their consistency, their attitude, and the fact that they do most of the basics very well. You run into other horses that have, you know, difficulty with the basics and with doing the things they need to do to be successful, and that's a frustrating process, because at the end of the day, they're animals and they have only their own limitations, and you as the trainer have to try to bring out the best in each one of them. But for sure, being around nice horses, there's nothing that beats it.
Well, and you've had the chance to do that quite often in recent years. And this past year, you had the opportunity to do it in Dubai, where you were the only American trainer with horses at the Dubai Carnival. Talk about that decision and what went into making that trip over to Dubai.
Yeah, well, I was given the opportunity to train over there privately for, you know, an operation that I had one horse that was definitely going. I was going to just send one guy over there and let him handle it and be a part of it kind of from a distance. But as it got to the end of the year, I looked over what I had here and just the direction that they were all heading. And I felt like, you know, I had an opportunity to do something different if I needed to. And shortly after the new year, I arranged a business contract to work the carnival in Dubai, and I thought it was a great opportunity to do something different, and I'm really glad I did it. I mean, it was an experience that I probably couldn't have imagined what I was getting into, but it was excellent in the fact that it was dealing with older horses, class horses, more of European form. And then just the way they do everything in Dubai is really top-notch. I mean, the quality, the program, there's a lot of differences in the way that they run over there, the classifications of racing, what you need to know about, you know, just the basics as a trainer. I would say it's more of a European style. And the whole experience was really amazing, and I really enjoyed it. We were able to be a part of the World Cup program, and it's one of those experiences that I really want to build in. Since I have come back here to the States, I've felt very strongly and talked to a lot of people that we should be over there every year. You know, that America should have a stable and some representation over there every winter. And that's really, as well as building a stable here at home once again, also, a big goal of mine is to have a stable of horses there for the winter carnival every year and to be a part of that team.
So I can assume it's safe to say that you're going back in 2014?
Yes, we are going back in 2014. We've dealt with a lot of great people in the interim, you know, to try to get this thing off the ground. We're looking forward to going back. Sure.
What are the main challenges that you face when you take a stable to Dubai, or you go there and you work with other people's horses? What are the main challenges you face in terms of trying to be successful in the desert?
Well, I think that the most important thing, because you know, before Animal Kingdom went over there and was so successful, I think a lot of people had the feeling that since they had gone to the artificial, that it just wasn't favoring American horses. And I understand that because the results speak for themselves. But that being said, I think that there's a definite niche that our horses here can fill over there. And that just because they had the surface change doesn't mean that we can't then adjust and pick the right horses to run there. You know, I think a dirt horse will have problems over there if that's all that he has on his resume, because the artificial surface is really quite different. And then obviously they have the turf option. So I feel like we need to curtail what we're looking for and focus on turf horses or synthetic horses and really look at horses of top quality that are coming into the year later, kind of peaking later in the season, for one reason or another. You know, everybody has setbacks maybe in the beginning of the summer and they're not really coming along until this time of the year. Those type of horses make for great carnival horses, and there's a lot of money over there. There's a lot of upside. You never have to worry about the weather when it comes to the turf. You never have to worry about getting rained off. And, you know, I think the classification system, the way that the horses are rated is very important. You know, over here we have horses go through conditions. Over there, there's more of an international horse rating. So depending on how your horses are rated, you'll run in certain races. And I think, you know, certain horses that are here in the States that are running up against really hard circumstances because of the way the conditions are written can go over to Dubai and find new life under the different classification and how we run it. So there's many things that make it appealing. As soon as I came back from Dubai, I began talking to people, and it was amazing because really when people think of Dubai, they think of one night. They think of the World Cup and all the races that are being a part of that. And they say to themselves, well, if we have a really, really nice horse, maybe one day we'll go to Dubai. But the season starts much, much earlier than that. It starts in January and runs all the way to the end of March. And that's obviously the winter carnival. And I'm convinced that if we pick the right group of horses, we can go over there and represent ourselves well and be very competitive throughout the carnival rather than just on one night.
Well, and didn't I read somewhere that you had a prominent political leader as one of your big clients when you first got to Dubai?
Yeah. I mean, he was very influential in Dubai and had a nice stable of horses. And that's really the opportunity that led me to this idea. You know, if it wasn't for that opportunity, then I wouldn't be talking here about what the experience is like. So I was fortunate in that.
Seth Benzel joining me on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Seth, only a couple of minutes left. Believe it or not, this has really flown by. But you've always been very aware of the people around you, which have helped make the game go and helped make you successful. Talk about some of those people and clients you've had the privilege to be involved with.
Yeah, well, we've been very fortunate to represent some great clients. Eugene Melnick has been very substantial in our support and is very interested in the Dubai program as well. We've also received support from Zayat Racing Stables, looking forward to being part of the Dubai program this year. In the past, I've had a great run with Live Oak Plantation and Charlotte Weber. She's been a great support of ours, and we've really enjoyed, horses like Dynaslu and others. So we've been very fortunate to represent some great owners in the game and look forward to doing that down the line. Currently, we have Horses for Commonwealth Stable, who's a great new partnership, and they're looking at investing more and growing as a stable. Sam Sample has a great Commonwealth attitude and the fact that he's formed a partnership for the best of everybody, and I think it's something that you'll really hear a lot about over the next couple of years.
How many times have you sat rinkside for the Ottawa Senators?
No, I haven't gotten a chance to have that ticket, but maybe one of these days. We've been too busy, but hopefully one of these days we'll make it for sure.
Of course, Eugene Melnick, the owner of the Ottawa Senators in the National Hockey League. Seth, it's been a lot of fun to catch up with you and to visit with you and to hear your story, and it's truly fascinating, and want to wish you all the best in Dubai and, of course, moving forward with your operation, and looking forward to catching up with you up the road, my friend.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me on, and I'm a big fan. Keep it up. Great work.
Thanks so much. Seth Benzel here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Fascinating. A kid growing up in a town of 2,500 people in New York, now traveling to Dubai and working on trying to get the American presence even stronger for the Dubai Carnival. You just never know. It's a great game, great sport. We're going to hear from trainer Chris Richard coming up in the second half of the program, the native of Louisiana. We'll talk to him about his operation. That's a good story, too. Stay tuned for that. Here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasig Tipton.
It can get pretty hot in February, especially at the Fasig Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale. The 2013 sale produced 27 horses selling for $100,000 or more and 7 horses selling for more than $500,000, with the top 5 prices spanning from $625,000 all the way up to $900,000. With a sale average of more than $56,000, be sure you don't get left out in the cold. Enter your horse now for the Fasig Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale, taking place February 10th in Lexington, Kentucky.
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Ullman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets, and now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right. For the first time ever, get free Daily Racing Form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love, and DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, free guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, breaking news, analysis, and wagering on the go, grow with DRF and DRF Bets Mobile, one-click multi-ticket wagers with DRF Ticketmaker, and now free daily racing form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF Bets. Join today and wager with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
The 2013 Daily Racing Form National Handicapping Championship Tour is off and running with tournaments virtually every week. Last year's NHC and Tour had total prize money of nearly $1.8 million. Jim Bennis, a horse player from Chicago, Illinois, landed the grand prize of $750,000, an Eclipse Award, and the title Handicapper of the Year. Find out more by visiting nhctour.com and join the tour today to begin your quest for the NHC in January 2014 in Las Vegas.
RaceHorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RaceHorseReport.com. Make RaceHorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RaceHorseReport.com.
You can be a better bettor just by knowing how a horse is working.
For the first time ever, RacingWithBruno.com's reports are available straight from the source.
Racing with Bruno's With the Works takes you behind the past performances into the morning routines that matter most.
With over 20 years of experience, our team of analysts specialize in first-time starters and layoff horses, as well as full-card workout reports and selections.
Go to RacingWithBruno.com.
Now with the works.
This is David Cohen.
This is Gary Siaka.
This is David Jacobson.
This is Gary Golo.
This is Bruce Brown, and you're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
HRRN Live brings you live racing from tracks across the country. Join Chad Summers and the HRRN broadcast team as we bring you live racing every Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on our new channel, XM208, or streaming live online at horseracingradio.net. HRRN Live is your source for live thoroughbred racing from coast to coast, only on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Go to hrrnlive.com for a complete schedule of tracks and races.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. Really fun visit in the first half of the program with trainer Seth Benzel. A tremendous story and great to hear how he's doing and doing very well with his operation right now, and want to wish him all the best. Looking forward to our guest coming up here in the second half of the program, but want to give you a quick reminder to make plans to be right here in Lexington, Kentucky on February 10th for the Phasic Tipton Kentucky Winter Mixed Sale. That's the first sale of 2014 for Phasic Tipton, and you can look for bigger and better things from Phasic Tipton as we move forward throughout the year. It's been a tremendous 2013. Looking forward to building on that momentum again next year. So that's the Kentucky Winter Mix Sale right here in Lexington, Kentucky on February 10th. Chris Richard, the 42-year-old native of Ragley, Louisiana. He began training horses on his own back in the late 90s, and since that time, he has saddled 620 career winners. Those runners have earned $12.6 million in purses, and he is in the midst of his best year thus far. He's with us now on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Chris, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking the time.
No problem. Thanks for you guys having me on.
Yeah, happy to have you on board, and I'm just curious, how often does your last name get mispronounced?
Quite often. It goes back to college, so I'll answer to just about anything.
It is actually spelled like Richard, R-A-R-I-C-H-A-R-D, but it's the French pronunciation, if I'm not mistaken, right?
That is correct. It's pronounced Richard, but I've been called Richard, Richards, Richard. I answered all of them.
Well, look, you like so many other trainers I've had the chance to talk with on this program, grew up with your grandfather being one person that helped you get into the sport. Talk a little bit about that.
My grandfather, Francis Guillory, he was a small trainer in Louisiana, and I mean, we're talking about smallest on the smallest of scales that you could have. He was retired, and he just had one or two horses, and, you know, I'd go to the track with him, and, you know, we'd have a lot of fun. I'd take care of the horses, and, you know, he'd go up front, and he got to socialize with all of his buddies. We'd go to Delta Downs and the Evangeline Downs, and, you know, he was really the first, you know, trainer per se, you know, that I worked for, but he was family. And that's kind of how I got into the business, you know, once I was in my teenage years.
Yeah, you were obviously a very young child when you started going to the races with your grandfather and being around it. How old were you when you first remember hanging out at the races with him?
Oh, wow. I was young at that point. Well, I would say I was probably anywhere from when we first started going to the races at Delta Downs, probably somewhere around 8 to 10 years old.
What do you remember about those days?
I remember they wouldn't let the kids in. That's what I remember. And I had to stand outside of the chain link fence. That's what I remember the most about Delta Downs.
Well, don't feel bad. We talked to Nick Zito a couple of months ago, and he told us that it was the same thing for him when he started going. He had to wait with the security guard out at Aqueduct. He couldn't even get into the races there.
No, it was the same way. You know, you had the grandstand, and then you had the big area, probably about an eighth of a mile before the finish line, and they had a big chain link fence. It was actually too tall to climb over. I tried, you know. And you had to stay outside this chain link fence. That's what I remember the most. It was a lot of fun. We started off with, you know, watching the quarter horses, and then eventually, you know, getting more interested in the thoroughbreds. But I just remember, you know, that's kind of the funniest thing is I remember I went with my parents a lot as well. We just bring lawn chairs, and they would sit on the inside of the chain link fence, and I would sit on the outside of the chain link fence.
Were your parents involved with the game as well, or did they just go because of your grandfather?
They went because of my grandfather, and also we did have some very close friends of the family that had some quarter horses, and we would always go watch their horses run. And that's, you know, kind of what, you know, as well got us interested in it as well. But, you know, they weren't per se, you know, my dad wasn't a trainer or anything of that fashion, you know. But that's kind of how we got started into it is, you know, with my grandfather and friends of the family having some quarter horses that they'd race at Delta, and we'd go watch their horses run.
So did you always have an idea that this was what you were going to do, that you wanted to be a trainer, or did you have other things within the sport that you thought about doing, or maybe even outside of thoroughbred racing?
I never thought about doing anything outside of thoroughbred racing. It's actually a little comical. When I first started going to the races, I was going to be a jockey. Yep, I was going to be a jockey.
and this is funny why?
One, so that didn't work out too well.
Right. Yeah, it's funny that you say that because Seth Benzel joined me in the first half of the program, and he said the very same thing. He wanted to be a jockey, but he decided he liked to eat too much, so he wanted to eat whatever he wanted to eat when he wanted to eat it, so that whole jockey thing didn't go so well.
Yeah, it didn't go so well. I learned how to exercise horses, and I learned how to breathe horses, and I actually well, I shouldn't be saying this on the air if my mother hears, so she'll have heart seizure. I actually rode in a race at one of the brush tracks in Louisiana called Mamou Downs, and went there with my grandfather one time. We never told her about it.
Yeah,
but
wait,
I was one for one. I retired undefeated.
Your mom doesn't know that you rode in that race?
No, I never told her.
Until right now, of course.
Yeah, until right now, but I'm pretty, you know, I'm hopefully she's not listening.
Wow, and you actually won the race.
Yeah, I won the race. It was Mamou Downs. Oh, my goodness, how long ago was that? I couldn't have been but a young teenager. You'd have to understand this was a long time ago in Louisiana. And, you know, Pawpaw had probably had a little too much moonshine that day. I don't even know if I should be saying that on the air as well. But, you know, I ended up riding one of his horse's friends and really didn't know what I was doing, but it was a quarter horse, and this thing broke like a scalded ape, and it took off running. and I just held on for dear life. And then what I remember is back in the old days, it was just a straightaway, and you had to get him pulled up by a certain time. Well, I couldn't get the horse pulled up, and he jumped the levee and ended up in the rice field. Took me a while to get him back.
That is a great story. What was the name of the horse? Do you remember?
I don't remember the name of the horse. Like I said, that was I wish I could. It was something black, but I don't remember the name of the horse.
So when you finally told your grandfather and your parents that, hey, I want to be a trainer, I want to follow in my grandfather's footsteps, what was their reaction?
They were all supportive. You know, they were all supportive. You know, I told them from a very early age that I was going to train racehorses. And, you know, the one thing that was very important to my parents is that that was fine. I mean, they're big horse racing fans. You know, they just wanted to make sure I got my education. That was just the main important thing to them. You know, they wanted to make sure that that I went to college and I got my education. If it was something related to the horses, that's great. But, you know, they were all for it. And like I said, they're my biggest fans, and they're both very avid horse racing fans.
Well, they had to be proud, because not only did you go to college, you went to two colleges. You were a cowboy at McNeese State and then finished up as an Aggie at Texas A&M. But talk about those decisions and going to those two schools.
Okay, well, you know, I went, being I was from Ragley, which is only about 30 minutes away from Lake Charles, where McNeese State is located. My middle brother, Ray, I have two brothers, my oldest brother, Joe, and my middle brother, Ray. Ray had went his freshman year at McNeese State. And, you know, when I was done with high school, I went there. They had a small equine program. You know, wasn't on a large scale, but that's what I was going to major in. And it's kind of funny how things take a turn sometimes. My dad got transferred to Houston, Texas. He worked for Shell. And it just so happened that both my brothers, who both were married young and have families, they ended up moving to Houston, Texas as well. So all my entire immediate family moved to Houston, Texas, and they wanted me to go meet them, and that's what I ended up doing. So I moved to Houston, checked out the colleges, and found out that Texas A&M had a very, very good equine department, an outstanding animal science program, and, you know, and I said that's where I'm going to focus on, and that's how I ended up at Texas A&M.
Yeah, and you have dual degrees from Texas A&M, if I'm not mistaken, right?
I do. I got my animal science, and I'm sorry, I got my bachelor's degree in animal equine science, and I got my master's degree in equine nutrition exercise physiology.
Talking with trainer Chris Richard here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. How about your brothers? You mentioned Joe and Ray. Are they involved with racing at all?
They are not. They are not. They never took to it. They would go to the races with me, and you know, actually, me and my dad actually got us a quarter horse one time. We didn't do very well with him, but we got us a quarter horse, so we'd go to Delta Downs, and you know, exercise him and things of that nature. And they you know, at that time, I wasn't old enough to drive, at least not legally, anyway, and so. You know, they drive me, but they never got into it very much. And that they're, you know, big fans of mine, and they'll watch my horses run, but they never had the passion or, you know, the energy that I had for that. They kind of did their own other thing. They like horse racing, but they never pursued it as a career in any fashion.
Do they ever call you looking for tips?
Oh, all the time. I give them a tip every time. I said, yeah, here's your tip. Don't bet.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, that must be a little bit difficult for you, because if you say, well, you know, my horse is doing really well, and, you know, maybe this will be the day for him, and they bet on him and the horse doesn't run so well, with that sibling rivalry, I can imagine that must not go over too well.
Oh, they try me every now and then. If they call me up and I tell them, I think, you know, and I never, ever make the cardinal sin of saying a horse is going to win. I just say, I think the horse is doing good and he has a big shot. They bet a few bucks on him, then they'll call me up and tell me I'm a bad trainer and they want a refund. and I'll tell them, hey, you knew I was a bad trainer before you bet on me. So, you know, good luck with that.
Wow. Well, not only were you getting multiple degrees at Texas A&M, but you were also working in the business with Carter Wallace Farm. And I can imagine that that was a time that you really not only learned things in the classroom, but got a chance to learn firsthand by doing things at the farm as well.
Absolutely. I think that was a big influence on me. And I tell people all the time when some of the younger people, you know, that are in their late teens, early 20s, I tell them that regardless of what you're going to do in life, and this was stuff that was preached to me at Texas A&M from all the professors and advisors, regardless what you're going to do in life, you have to get experience doing it. You can't go to school and just get degrees without experience, because very unfortunate, and professors get mad when I say this, but it is the gospel, it's the truth. What is, you know, necessarily works in the classroom does not necessarily work in practicality and real life, and that's in anything that you do, whether it's any business that you do, whether it's lawyers, whether it's engineers, you know, you have to get out there and get experience. And you know, when you can combine experience, your practical experience, and go to school and get your technical experience, I think that can give you a competitive advantage in everything, in, you know, any business, in anything that you do. So I think that was crucial, you know, starting to working at the farms. I actually had a class where we took a two-week field trip, and we went through all these farms in Texas. We went to Remington Park in Oklahoma back in the day. We went all the way up to Kentucky. We went to all the major farms in Kentucky. We came back down through Arkansas and then came back to Texas. And it was actually, I got 2 hours of credit for it. And you had to write, you know, an essay when you were done. But one of the requirements to finish the class was every single place that we went, you had to write a letter thanking the people for their time of seeing us, and also sending a resume to every single place that we went. You sent a letter of thank you, and you also typed up, and you had yourself a resume, and that was part of the requirements to finish the class. And that's how I actually got hired by two places that year. I was actually hired by Carter Walsh Farm in Texas. It was near Denton, Texas, the Fort Worth area. And I worked for them, great people. I worked for them on and off throughout college. And I actually came up and worked for TaylorMade in the winter sale that same year and worked the January sale as well.
Well, Chris Richard joining us here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton, somebody who certainly learned the game from the ground up. And as you can tell, that's benefiting him with what he's doing now with training horses. You actually caught a pretty good break right out of college. And I guess it was a professor of yours that introduced you to the man known as Mattress Mac.
Yep, that is correct. I actually, when I was in grad school, Dr. Gary Potter was on my board. And he was actually my chief board staff member, and he was the head of my committee in grad school, and it just was just kind of good timing. A lot of things in life, you know the timing has to be correct, and I was just finishing up my master's degree, writing my thesis was almost done, and McInville called him up and said, you know, I'm looking for somebody young with a little bit of a different perspective from a training perspective, with a little bit more scientific background. Would you be able to know anybody with that? And, of course, Dr. Potter said, you know what? I've got a guy just finishing up right now. He's been working in the industry, been around racehorses, you know, since he was old enough to walk. And he's just finishing up with his master's in nutrition. I think this would be a guy you'd be interested in. And that's how I got introduced to McInville.
Yeah, talking about Texas racing icon James McInville and going to work for him fresh out of college, your very first job as a private trainer, that had to be, I can imagine, somewhat intimidating. Is that the right way to put it?
I guess you could.
Yeah.
I guess you could say it was intimidating. You know, it was one of those situations where I look back and I almost want to laugh. I was young, and I think with anybody that was young, you think you know more than you actually do. And I was no exception, unfortunately. And, you know, I thought I had it all figured out. It was going to be easy. And, you know, we got thumped pretty good the 2 years. We had a lot of fun, and I was very fortunate, you know, to have that opportunity to work for Mac. And Mac wanted to try a lot of different things, you know, and so we were unconventional with our training methods. We were unconventional with how we approach things, because that's Mac's forte. He likes to try different things. But at the end of the day, we worked hard. We had, you know, and I enjoyed my time with that, but we weren't nearly as successful as we would have liked. But it was definitely a learning experience for me. And I look back, and that was just part of the process. You know, you gotta go through the process. You gotta take your lumps, and that was part of the process.
Yeah, looking back on that chapter, if you could go back and do it all over again, what are some of the things you would do differently, Chris?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that I would probably do differently is I would be able to talk to Mac a little bit better now than I did back then. You know, I was probably a little intimidated by Mac back then. Not that Mac was mean or anything of that nature, but, you know, Mac's brilliant. Mac is absolutely brilliant at everything that he does. But, you know, I can remember one. I probably shouldn't say this either. I hope he's not listening. He don't like it when I tell stories about him. But you know, we ran a horse one time that he paid a lot of money for. He was very well bred. I think he paid $700,000 for something for this horse, and the horse just wasn't very good. The horse was already there when I got there, and we ran him first time out. And I think he beat one horse, and he was furious after the race. And you know, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know exactly other than to say, you know, we'll try to do better next time, you know. You know, and he said, well, excuse me, Chris, why I go stick my head in the toilet and flush it? So I was like, well, I'll be more than happy to help you with that, you know.
Yeah, you could always fall back on he didn't handle the track.
Yeah, you know, and so, but Mac was great. And, you know, I still train for Mac. I still got a couple of horses for Mac. And it was a learning experience for both of us. I think it opened our eyes up that it's not as easy as it looks. And, you know, there's certain, you have a guideline in order to be successful in this business, because this business has been around a long time. And not that you shouldn't try different things, and not that you should not try to improve, because I always try to improve. Every day I try to become a better trainer, and I try to improve every single thing that I do. And I try to maximize the performance of every single horse that I got in my barn. If they're a $5,000 horse, I try to get the maximum performance out of those $5,000 horses. And I get a lot of sense of accomplishment when I win races. It's really, you know, it's not about anything other than the horses and the sense of accomplishment. You know, it's never been about that. I was talking to some people one time, some new owners, and I said, you know, the way I look at it is some people train to enrich their lives, some people train to define their lives, and I choose the latter. You know, I train to define who I am. And it's got nothing to do with monetary value. It really doesn't. I get a lot of satisfaction in the challenge of dealing with the horses and trying to get maximum out of every single horse and treat every single horse as an individual. But that being said, there is a guideline that you need to kind of stick close to on how you train. When you start venturing and going left wing and trying these radical new ways to do things, yeah, a lot of the times that doesn't work out as well as what you would like it to. And that was a situation where we were trying radical training methods, and we were trying, you know, different things, and it just didn't, you know, work out as well as what we would have liked to. And if I would go back and I could do, you know, one thing over, I could talk to Mac a little bit better than I did back then, because, like I said, I was young and I was probably a little more intimidated. And, you know, and I would have been a little bit more, if I didn't like something, I would say, hey, I don't think this is a good idea. I don't think this is going to improve performance. But I was a private trainer back then, and, you know, we were trying new and different things. And, it, like I said, other other than that, I don't look back on that experience as a negative. I look back on it as a positive, because I think that helped define the trainer that I am today.
Yeah, with those things being said and talking about having your profession define you, what would you consider to be your career highlight to this point, Chris?
Well, I think that's an easy one. I've been fortunate to be around some pretty nice horses, you know, going back to my days, even when I worked for Tom Amos as an assistant trainer. That was my second job after, you know, when I left Mackinville, I went to work for Tom Amos as an assistant. So I was around some pretty fortunate, some really nice horses. I was fortunate to be around them. But a couple of years ago, me and Maggie Moss claimed a horse called Out of Tune. And he was a horse that it's had a long history with, and I'll put it very briefly. She claimed the horse when he was 3 years old, at the end of his three-year-old season.
Okay.
And he got really good for her and Tom. And he was on the verge of becoming a stakes horse, I thought. But he got injured in a workout, and he broke his back sesamoid.
Okay.
And the prognosis was not good at all. Rude and Riddle basically told her, you know, the prognosis is not good. He probably won't be a racehorse when this heals. He'll probably just be a riding horse. And she had talked to me at length, and I said, you know, you just need to turn that horse out and forget about him. Just let him be at the farm. Let it heal. Let's see what it's going to do come next year. So she gave him a whole year off. And the horse came back sound. But he had to, when he come back into training, he developed some breathing issues. So we had him at Prairie Meadows, and we ran him, you know, a couple of times, and he won in some claiming races. I think we ran him for somewhere between the $17,500 and $20,000 claiming level, and he won a couple of races, and he got claimed, and we kind of lost track of him. The very next year, he showed up back at Prairie Meadows running for $5,000. Maggie and I chatted about him, and she made the decision that she said, you know what, I'm like you. I'd like the horse back. And if his breathing has gotten worse, I'll just retire him. And I said, okay. So we claimed him back, and his breathing hadn't got any worse. But, he still had some issues with his throat. He would get a lot of throat infections, and you really had to monitor that and manage that very closely. And he was having some bleeding problems. And, you know, the horse just needed to get really healthy. He had got hit with a really bad skin disease. He only had half of his hair. He just really wasn't happy and healthy. So we just tried to get him happy and healthy again, clear out the throat infection. And we took him to Oaklawn Park the following year, and he got so good. And he won four in a row, and he was winning allowance races, and he topped it off by winning the 250,000 count fleet, a
wow.
Grade 3 stakes race, which was my very first graded stakes race win. And the sense of accomplishment, I'm still high on what that horse has accomplished. And it's all about Out of Tune, because he had the potential to be that kind of horse earlier in his career. And because of all the physical setbacks, he never got there. And to see him do it when he was 7 years old was just, I can't put it into words how elated I was. But I give him all the credit. He was cut out to be a really good horse, but he had so many physical problems. For him to overcome those, that's probably the highlight, I'd say the number one highlight of my training career so far.
Yeah, and easy to see why. That's an amazing story, and congrats to you and to Maggie and to everybody involved with that horse. That's just so cool, and that's what this sport is really all about. Chris, believe it or not, we're down to about 1 minute left here, so just want to ask you quickly, what other interests does Chris Richard have outside of horse racing when you're not at the track?
I'm kind of a boring guy, I guess. I really don't have a lot of interest other than, I like to read a lot, and I like history. I like the History Channel, and I like learning history, world history, anything that's kind of related to history. I'm kind of a real history buff now, but really, I'm just kind of I'm just kind of, I wear my blinkers, and I really focus on my horses 24/7. And like I said, other than reading and becoming a little bit of a history buff, I don't have a lot of hobbies.
Well, Chris, it's been a great visit, and you do one thing extremely well, and that's focusing on thoroughbred racing. So keep up the great work, and all the best with continued success here into 2014 and beyond.
Thank you guys so much, and I appreciate you guys having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Chris Richard here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Seth Benzel in the first half of the show. If you missed any portion, check out a podcast at horseracingradio.net. For Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening.